Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll hear about how restrictions on hospital visits has impacted family members and patients, many who feel isolated due to the safety guidelines at the facilities. Chicago has put rules in place for tourists coming to the city. One is a quarantining for 2 weeks upon arrival to make sure people don't spread the coronavirus. Not all are following the protocol.
2 week quarantine really isn't an option, and we had this trip planned long before all of this stuff, so we were going to back out of it just because of an order that's unenforceable.
We'll have more on that, and the pandemic has not stopped domestic violence. In fact, the problem may be worse. That's some of what we have coming this hour on Statewide. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, despite a lot of cancellations, 4-H has continued through the pandemic. We'll hear how that program is working. Calls to a domestic violence hotline are way up this year. We'll take a closer look at why. And when the coronavirus is separating us, there are still ways to come together. One woman talks about being part of a large virtual choir. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. Many hospitals stopped allowing visitors to their intensive care units months ago. Public health experts say it's a necessary step to reduce the chances of spreading the coronavirus. But as Shayla Farzan with St. Louis Public Radio reports, not being able to see their sick loved ones also takes an emotional toll on families.
In late March, Celeste Marks developed what felt like the common cold. But then the 66-year-old started feeling strange.
It was almost as if I was going to throw up when I started to cough. And I would at times, you know, I would just start gagging. I just felt so incredibly lousy, very, very weak.
She kept feeling worse. And a couple days later, her temperature shot up and it got harder to breathe. Marks has lupus, a chronic autoimmune disease that increases her risk of getting infections. So her husband, Len, and their youngest daughter drove Marks to St. Luke's Hospital in Chesterfield. At the time, only one family member could wait in the ER, so the three of them said goodbye at the door.
They both left. And when they left, I was just like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And yeah, I did feel alone and isolated. I really did.
Marks tested positive for the coronavirus and was diagnosed with pneumonia. At home, Len Marks was calling the hospital 3 or 4 times a day. He pictured his wife laying in a hospital bed, gasping for air, and he felt helpless. So he started carrying around a spiral notebook, and whenever he talked to the doctors and nurses, he frantically scribbled down as much as he could.
I was writing like a high school student, quickly, okay, tell me more. The learning curve on all this, I never knew what an oxygen saturation level was until this.
Mark started sleeping with his cell phone on his pillow. And on Sunday morning, a week after his wife was admitted, the hospital called. Celeste Marks was about to be put on a ventilator, and she wanted to see a priest beforehand. Len Marks remembers his daughter, Lisa, who has autism, turning to him that day with a question.
We got the call that she was going to the ICU. And Lisa, just rather casually, with a serious kind of voice, is mom going to die today? And boy, does that hit you, you know?
They're one of tens of thousands of families in the U.S. with loved ones who have been hospitalized for COVID-19. Before the pandemic, most ICUs allowed families to visit. But as the coronavirus swept across the country this spring and patients crowded into ICUs, it became too risky to let visitors inside. Tracy Montauk is a registered nurse at St. Louis University Hospital. Until recently, she worked in one of their ICU units. And she says things looked very different there before the outbreak.
Families, you know, could just be in the room and play music on their iPhone for their family members, or tell them what was going on in the neighborhood, or tell them a funny story about their dog, even if these patients were mostly on the ventilator.
And she says families could be more involved in the medical care of their loved ones.
I think by just being in the room, families were able to absorb a lot of information, and they were able to have, you know, continuous and repeated conversations and questions answered in real time.
Montauk says there are very good reasons for keeping visitors out of the ICU in a pandemic. But she says a lot of families are anxious about their sick relatives, and not being able to see them is painful. She recently co-authored a paper with recommendations for ICU staff during the pandemic, like not being afraid to show emotion in front of families and using video chat as early as possible.
We would kind of give them a tour. Here's the room they're in. Here's the monitors. That's what this all this stuff means. This is the medicines.
But despite the best efforts of staff members, being isolated in the hospital with COVID-19 can be incredibly traumatic for patients and their families. Amanda Blackwell lives in East St. Louis and works in admissions in the ER at St. Alexius Hospital. In late March, the 38-year-old got sick, really sick. She remembers crawling to the bathroom, barely able to breathe.
My mother was calling me every day, all day, and I remember talking to her, and I remember her upset, and she was crying, and she said, please call them, because I'm her only child. You know, she begs me, and I finally called 911.
Blackwell tested positive for the coronavirus at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in O'Fallon, and the next day, she was put on a ventilator. She woke up 23 days later.
I was really confused. I was scared. One of the nurses was really sweet, and I was on isolation. She brought her phone in there to let my mom talk to me, and I didn't even know who my mom was. But I kept looking at the lady going, like, I'm shaking my head, like, I don't know who this is. It was my mother. I had no idea who she was.
Being on a ventilator for that long is really hard on your body. Blackwell went through weeks of rehab, learning how to walk and talk again. When she finally got out of the hospital in late May, almost 2 months after being admitted, her mom was there.
Oh my God, I just cried. I just grabbed her, didn't want to let her go.
Blackwell says it was traumatic for her mom, waiting at home all those weeks, knowing she might never see her daughter again. The experience took a serious toll on her mom, Blackwell says, and she won't discuss the experience with anyone but her daughter. Clinical social worker and therapist Velma Bell works with trauma patients and their families. She says being present when a loved one is ill is often an important part of our rituals around sickness and death. And for some people, it provides a sense of purpose.
I think we believe a voice or a touch or a smell can somehow provide relief and support, you know, for that person to fight and hold on.
For Celeste Marks, the patient in Chesterfield, knowing that her husband and daughter were waiting at home was motivation to get better. After spending more than 3 weeks in the hospital, she was discharged. She says that day, when her husband picked her up, was one of the happiest in her life.
I was even afraid to touch him, you know, but he just came right over to me and kissed me. We both had masks on, and that was just so wonderful. That was just so wonderful.
But Mark says she still feels guilty, knowing what her family went through, and she hopes they'll never have to experience that again. I'm Shayla Farzan.
State of Illinois' domestic violence hotline has been busy. Overall, calls have climbed over last year by more than 30% since the state's stay-at-home order was lifted, and text message contacts have soared as well. Maureen McKinney looked at what caused the change.
Franny Coles, now estranged husband, had been emotionally abusive and financially controlling. She thinks sometimes about what might have happened had she not gathered the strength to leave prior to the coronavirus pandemic.
I can't even imagine what it would be like to have the fear that you were going to be physically hurt, although I can't be certain that it wouldn't have gone that way had, you know, we been stuck for 6 straight weeks under the same roof.
We're using a pseudonym for the 48-year-old St. Clair County woman at her request. Her sense that Illinois' stay-at-home order between March 21st and the end of May would create stressors pushing abusers to the boiling point is accurate, say advocates of survivors of domestic abuse. Calls to Illinois' domestic violence hotline were up 17% compared to last year during the same period, March 21st to May 29th. Normally, from one year to the next, calls hold steady, said Olivia Farrell with the network advocating against domestic violence. The network runs the hotline. The pace of calls has been even greater since the stay-at-home order was lifted. Between the time the stay-at-home order ended and July 27th, calls were up 32% from the previous year. Meanwhile, texted messages grew by almost 2,000% during the stay-at-home period. Since then, there's been a more than 3,000% increase over the same time last year. The incidence of domestic violence was driven in part by a volatile mix. Seclusion, fear of COVID-19, and for many, loss of employment, Farrell said.
Folks in these isolated situations and these additional stressors really just lead to increased incidence of domestic violence.
Arlene Jones directs the Violence Prevention Center of Southwestern Illinois. Her agency, which covers three counties, saw the post-stay-at-home order increase in calls.
Survivors have been basically sheltered in with their abusers. They haven't had the opportunity to reach out for help. And as things have opened up a little bit in Illinois, we're getting more and more calls.
Beth Maskell runs the domestic violence program Voices in Northwestern Illinois. She's a theory on how underestimation of the impact of COVID-19 contributed.
I do think that there was some for victims that potentially if it was few weeks, maybe they could make it through, and then ultimately the financial crisis just came and, you know, people were not able to remain safe.
Jones said normally when an abuser exits a home, it gives survivors a chance to reach out to domestic violence support organizations.
If the abuser goes to work, that's an opportunity for them to make phone calls for help. If their children are going to school, that's an opportunity for them to get out of the house away from the abuser, to again call for help, or to escape if they need to escape. It's a lot more difficult when they're shut in with the abuser.
COVID-19 has limited options for escaping an abuser, Farrell said. She's witnessed a positive outcome as social distancing has forced some shelters to turn to hotels as havens for male abuse survivors. Calls from men have soared by 176% during the stay-at-home period and 104% since.
And shelters often have a very gendered model, so most of them will only serve female survivors. There are some that serve male survivors, but they are less frequent. So as we switched to some of these different programs, it allowed more male survivors to reach out during this time and get the help they needed, which was really wonderful.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
Well, what the world needs now is not only love, but peace, togetherness, and harmony. A Quad Cities woman found exactly that by being part of a huge virtual choir with over 17,000 singers from 129 nations. Herb Trix has that story.
Lynn Stuckart, a veteran flute teacher, is a fan of popular choral composer Eric Whitaker and his ambitious virtual choirs, a project that started in 2010 with individual videos from 185 singers from 12 countries, blended to perform a piece of his in perfect harmony. Previously, he's organized 5 of the virtual choirs, with each one bigger than the last. Stuckart saw on Facebook that Whitaker was looking for entries for a 6th and a new piece that he wrote the lyrics to called Sing Gently. Very fitting during the COVID-19 pandemic, when people can't gather to sing in the same place. As verses say, may we stand together always, may our voice be strong, may we hear the singing always, and may we always sing along, sing gently, always sing gently as one. She says about 40,000 people signed up to get the free music to the new piece, and over 17,000 recorded their individual 3-minute video from home, singing along with video of Whitaker conducting with piano accompaniment.
And I'm sure that the pandemic played a huge role in the numbers as well, because so many people don't have that outlet to sing with others right now.
Stuckart, who has sung in many choirs, performed the alto part, along with 6,400 other altos, 6,200 sopranos, 2,200 tenors, 2,600 basses, and 16 who did sign language. And she found the whole experience very inspiring.
You know, he talked about the importance of, you know, how right now so many people are reaching out to one another, and how now as we can share this video with one another, you know, it's like his whole message was healing. You know, music is joy. Music is joyful. It's community. It's comfort.
Each of the more than 17,000 videos was listened to separately and merged to create a seamless whole. Stuckart first saw the finished video on July 19th when it was released to the world, and following the piece, it took 7 minutes to list all the participants.
It's stunning. I mean, as I listened to it, I had it on full stereo, and I had goosebumps. Just really struck by the generosity of Eric and his team, how much so many people use music as comfort and joy, and then also can reach one another when we're supposed to be keeping distance.
She says the project revealed a sympathetic side of humanity, true camaraderie that's needed right now more than ever.
We have a lot going on worldwide, and especially in our country, but it just shows you there is goodness, there is kindness, there is compassion, and music really brings the best of all that together.
And for Jonathan Turner, I'm Herb Trix.
Stay with us. There's more ahead on Statewide, how 4-H is persevering. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear about another business casualty of the coronavirus, a Springfield catering business that's calling it quits. A lot of events and activities have been canceled the last few months because of COVID-19, but Illinois 4-H is still keeping kids busy, as Claire Buchanan tells us more.
This is what you can usually expect from a 4-H livestock show. But this year, they'll sound more like this. A typical 4-H livestock show happens at the county fair, where the kids are able to present their animals live in front of judges. But this year is anything but typical. And like every organization, 4-H has had to adjust how they do things.
We're hoping to not miss a beat.
That's Margaret Larson. She's the county director for the University of Illinois Extension for Joe Davies, Stevenson, and Winnebago counties. She says the shows are an important part of 4-H because they give kids an opportunity to present the projects they've been working on in front of an audience and get feedback from judges. In order to keep doing that during the pandemic, the shows have all shifted to a virtual format.
We feel very fortunate that we're able to offer the 4-H community a chance to continue with their project work and to show their project and be judged. And it's a very positive way for the 4-H members to get feedback and continue to grow.
Becky Gokin is program coordinator for Joe Davies, Stevenson, and Winnebago counties. She says kids in 4-H have been working on their projects all year. Typically, presentations happen in the summer and they're live. But this year, they have to be submitted through an online platform.
4-H decided that these kids have had enough disappointments. So many things have been taken from them. So many things have been canceled. But 4-H wanted to keep going on and show these kids and their families the support system is still there for them. The work they have done is still going to be appreciated and shown, just in a different format.
And that different format means some significant changes to how the projects are presented.
So the livestock shows are muted because they are not supposed to be speaking, so that they're not influencing the judge by having somebody in the background talking about what a wonderful steer this was.
Other projects, of course, need sound, like this winning public speaking entry by Michelle Mark. She's performing an excerpt from I Am Not a Bully by Ken Bradbury.
Being taunted and excluded by peers happened too often. Perhaps you know someone who has been bullied. Maybe you are that person. Or maybe you've just stood by and observed the bully.
Others have not translated quite as easily to an online experience.
I would say probably the most challenging show would probably be the cooking, just because our judges cannot taste the food this year. So what they have done is, for the cooking, they have to have specialized photographs. And then the recipe and things. And then they would also fill out a one-page project report.
A project report supplements questions the judges would ask during a live presentation. This year, the judges are working from home. Larson says 4-H is still figuring out exactly how, but that projects will be available for public viewing. And the kids and families involved have been thankful for the work they've put in so far to keep things going. One local 4-H club even had a new family join.
I guess when the pandemic happened, they decided, you know, they need their kids to be a part of something. And they just felt that during this time, that was going to be really important.
So while things might look a little different this year, 4-H is making it work. You might not be able to hear the livestock this year, but the kids in 4-H still get to participate, learn, and present the fruits of their labor. I'm Claire Buchanan.
Many Midwestern states saw a boom in their turkey hunting season earlier this year. Jonathan All with Harvest Public Media reports the coronavirus and the subsequent cancellation of many activities is behind the increase.
6-year-old Frank Girondo of Rolla, Missouri, went hunting for the first time this spring with his family. Frank says it was fun trying to outsmart a gobbler that came back to his family's blind several times.
Yeah, like this one was so smart. He never wanted to come close enough. But one day he got like come 30 yards and a shot.
But he missed. Still, Frank said he had a great time. The Girondo family of four went turkey hunting 13 times this season. Nick Girondo says that was 100% because of the coronavirus canceling soccer, baseball, and family trips.
With sports and other things going on, we probably maybe would have got out one day at the most this year, the way planning was going with family events. So, we got out a lot more than we normally would have because of the pandemic.
The hours and hours spent in the blind were good for the family. Jen Girondo says in a lot of ways it was better family time than what they would have been doing if not for the pandemic.
When they're playing sports, they're out with the coach, they're out, and we're kind of on the sidelines just watching and cheering. So for us, it was neat to get to be there to be their coach, I guess, kind of through hunting.
The Girondo family is part of the increase in turkey hunting across the Midwest this spring. Almost 20,000 new hunters tried out the sport in Missouri. Numbers were also up in Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska, and Kansas. Hunting proponents are welcoming the increase after a decade of declines. Eric Edwards is the Education Outreach Coordinator for the Missouri Department of Conservation. He says it's great that more people tried hunting, but is concerned the increase won't hold up at these levels once people can go back to their regularly scheduled activities.
Yes, people just had considerable amounts of free time on their hands this year, and we probably won't see these numbers again unless something like this happens again, but it would sure be nice if we could keep these numbers.
But some first-time hunters are planning to return. Carly Auble went hunting this spring when she won a raffle to go on a free trip. The suburban St. Louis resident says normally she would have passed on it, but was going stir-crazy at home, and the idea of being outdoors was too good to pass up. Auble says it's an exciting moment to see a turkey come out.
You know, your heart starts beating, you start shaking a little bit, and I would say I would have to do it again if I had the opportunity.
Even with the increased activity, the news wasn't good for all people in the hunting business. Rob Mihalovic and his siblings run Missouri Hunting and Outdoor, a 1,300-acre hunting ground in the Missouri Ozarks. He says they had 28 hunting groups from 9 states booked for turkey season. But because their property includes a lodge and dining facilities, they had to close because of coronavirus.
Looking at it, we just couldn't guarantee our staff's safety or our guests. So we had to cancel the season, and you know, it was very painful.
Mihaljevic says they hope to be fully open by deer season and are exploring adding campgrounds to their property to accommodate hunters if the lodge has to stay closed. He's also concerned the coronavirus increase in hunting will be a one-time thing. But Nick Girondo says the bonding his family had has him focusing on a new priority even after the pandemic.
To carve out that time, it showed how special it is to carve out that time and spend that time together. So to make sure we have that time as a group.
Summer is a slower time for hunting in the Midwest, so it's hard to tell if more families will follow the turkey hunting boom into other seasons. I'm Jonathan Aul.
Climate change and the environmental damage caused by large-scale agriculture have researchers searching for ways to increase productivity without furthering harm. Amy Mayer looks at a network of research sites across the country and here in the Midwest that over the past decade have started combining their local data into a national understanding of what might need to change.
On a windy June day, microbiologist Tom Moorman lifts a metal lid and reveals a collection of bottles, tubes, meters, and cables in a shallow pit on the edge of a farm field.
So you see in those bottles, and the labels 17, 18, 19, and 22.
Moorman works for the Agricultural Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Ames, Iowa. He explains that each bottle collects water running off one specific plot. His research team grows corn and soybeans. About half the plots are business as usual, planted, fertilized, harvested, and so forth, the way a local farmer might do it. But the others are what Moorman and his colleagues call aspirational.
So we have two basic ones that we're looking at here. Rye cover crops, which we've looked at for quite some time. But this particular treatment, instead of rye, we're trying to grow winter camelina.
Camelina is an oil seed that can be planted in the fall and harvested in the summer, even as soybeans are growing in the rows around it. Moorman's looking at whether the camelina helps reduce nutrient runoff. He measures that in the water collected in those plastic bottles. He's also hopeful camelina or some other option could ultimately offer traditional Midwest farmers a third cash crop in addition to corn and soybeans.
Agricultural scientists in the Midwest have spent a lot of time thinking about another big third crop, and we haven't come up with it exactly yet.
Moorman's team looks at row crops and water quality with additional locations in Minnesota and Wisconsin. They're one site in the long-term agroecosystem research network, which has 18 sites across the country. The overarching goal is to figure out how agriculture can scale up to feed more people while also reducing negative environmental impacts. And that takes time. In Michigan, the Kellogg Biological Station has been studying the impact of no-till farming for so long, Nick Haddad says the results are conclusive. Not turning over the land before planting is beneficial when you do it year after year.
If we had stopped at any point in that 30 years, we wouldn't know the extent that a less intense cropping system has on yield.
Plus, Haddad said no-till leads to higher soil moisture and keeps more carbon in the ground. He says the results likely would hold true on 20% to 40% of upper Midwest cornfields. But the agricultural landscape looks different in Nebraska, where there's more livestock and less water. The Platte River High Plains Aquifer site of the Agroecosystem Network has records on groundwater, pesticide residue, productivity.
We have several long-term data sets. Several of them goes back to the 70s, few goes back to the 40s.
Tala Awada of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln is a co-leader of the site.
The groundwater fluctuation goes back to the early 1900s.
These data have helped land managers advise local farmers for decades. Now, using the same business-as-usual versus aspirational framework, the whole research network is exploring water quantity and quality, greenhouse gas emissions, and other environmental impacts across many agricultural landscapes. The coordinated effort aims to illustrate how the different regions are related.
We are all facing changes in the environment, changes in climate that one of us cannot capture.
USDA's Teferi Tagaye is the national coordinator of the network. He says with a growing global population and no additional arable land, sustainably increasing production is a must.
We have one earth, basically. So you have to increase productivity with the same land that we are currently producing.
Researchers hope their work will demonstrate viable ways for farmers to do that. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
The coronavirus pandemic has hurt many small businesses. Olivia Mitchell has the story of a Springfield caterer closing after a quarter century.
When families, schools, or hospitals in Springfield hire McCormick's Catering and Smokehouse Craft Meats for events, Michelle Seelbach and her husband, Gary, say you get much more than excellent food.
They are so respectful to everyone. They have wonderful food. They also decorate.
Yeah, they were complete caterers in terms of the food, the beverages. They took care of everything.
Michelle and Gary are longtime friends and customers of the McCormick's.
Well, when they catered, if there was leftover food, they would offer for us to have it. If we didn't want it, they would then automatically take it to the St. John's Breadline.
The McCormick's has served the community for 26 years, but is now closing. And the owners, husband and wife Sarah and Jerry, are in financial trouble.
COVID-19 pretty much just wiped us out.
That's Sarah McCormick. The stay-at-home order issued in March caused problems for all kinds of businesses, including caterers. And limitations on gatherings continue, with no more than 50 people allowed to congregate at once.
And that was how we made a living every day. We fed large amounts of people. And if those aren't allowed to happen, basically our occupation has just been eliminated from the landscape of this country.
State and federal governments tried to step in to soften the blow with programs like the Paycheck Protection Program. But McCormick say the help didn't fit their business needs and they felt cut out. Jared says they were approved for a PPP loan, but his accountant instructed him not to take it.
He basically told me that was not a viable option, as long as gatherings were restricted.
The couple applied for a $10,000 emergency disaster grant through the Small Business Administration, but was only awarded $3,000. And since the business already had existing loans with the SBA, the McCormick's are at risk for losing much more than they imagined.
It's the collateral of our home. We spoke to attorneys first thing, along with our accountant when we went over the PPP loans, and they said, well, you can do bankruptcy, but you will lose everything.
But he doesn't think that businesses should be held accountable for closings due to the coronavirus pandemic. He encourages other businesses to take a stand.
A lot of businesses and people are going right to bankruptcy. And, if they have existing business loans and they're out of business and it wasn't their fault, I say challenge them.
Jared predicts more businesses closing in the future if the virus resurges and the rules of the loan programs, banks, and lenders do not change.
You know, once all this money dries up and the pandemic comes back, and it seems like it's coming back, that there's going to be a lot of us faced with homelessness.
Sarah is hoping the next round of federal loans will contain different rules so businesses like theirs won't be left out.
Hopefully that focus can shift to the businesses who cannot go on.
Kevin Luss, director of the Illinois Small Business Development Center at Lincoln Land Community College, says Congress, state, and local governments have been doing everything they could to help businesses stay afloat.
I feel like there's a concerted effort to help.
Congress recently passed a bill that would make it easier for businesses to use PPP loans, giving them 6 months instead of two to use funds and reducing the share of funding that must pay employees. Luss says the PPP has been beneficial for many businesses in the area, but some businesses have unique circumstances.
Well, we almost certainly will see additional businesses close their doors.
As the McCormick's announced their permanent closure, their business received the Reader's Choice Award for Best Caterer from the State Journal Register. Gary Seelbach, along with many other customers and friends, will miss them.
Small businesses seem to be left out in this, and they're one of the wonderful businesses that we worked with and utilized on a lot of occasions. Very unfortunate, and they will be missed.
I'm Olivia Mitchell.
Support for Statewide comes from AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. There's more of Statewide ahead. Don't forget to check out our website, statewideshow.com. All of our stories can be found there. And if you'd like to get our podcast each week, head to the NPR One app. Statewide, I'm Sean Crawford. Even during a pandemic, Chicago remains a popular destination for tourists. And there are rules in place for those visitors, but not all are following the guidelines. That story still ahead. Up next, we hear from Dr. Robert Smith, Dean of the College of Public Affairs and Administration at the University of Illinois Springfield. He provided us his latest commentary, which looks at baseball, politics, and ethics.
Please know I tried so hard to make this commentary an upbeat reflection of our current circumstances in comparison to our national pastime as the new and abbreviated Major League Baseball season finally begins. But as I started with a lighthearted tone, I soon discovered the serious side of the topic and maybe its connection to our national fabric. State and national politics have almost become the new national pastime. What else would we do these days except follow the latest drama? Who needs the excitement of a close call at home base or a well-executed double play? Heck, we have Donald Trump promoting COVID home remedies, a flurry of pardons streaming from the White House, Pelosi and McConnell wrestling over COVID-19 benefits, the courts ruling for the left and then the right, the economy and GDP in freefall. Protests and rioting spilling into the streets. Plenty of action on all fronts. When it comes to politics, my neighbors and friends say, well, you know, they are all liars and cheaters and in it for themselves, and the only thing that matters in politics is winning and being right. Scandals are left and right these days at all levels of government. Corporate fraud and missteps are everywhere too. And maybe even everyday people are not being as nice to each other these days. Where is our societal ethical compass? But baseball is different. The pure joy of heading to the sandlot to play a pickup game, or suiting up for the softball or baseball game, heading to a minor league or major league game with the family. Those are, or were, the good old days. Times were simpler and baseball somehow helped us escape, and it was a great escape, if only for 9 innings. But then I thought, is that really true? I can't help but think about an off-season story that just jumped off the pages, at least for me. The story, of course, is the Houston Astros sign-stealing scandal. Those baseball aficionados might say, what's the big deal? Stealing signs to help teams win has always been a part of the game. Maybe, but does that make it right? In January of last year, Major League Baseball confirmed that the Astros illegally used a camera system to steal signs during the 2017 regular season and postseason, during which they won the World Series, as well as in part of the 2018 season. Several managers were fired, the Astros got fined $5 million, and forfeited their first and second round draft picks. No players were punished. As you look at the history of baseball, whether it was Shoeless Joe Jackson of our stalwart Chicago White Sox conspiring to fix the 1919 World Series, or more recently Pete Rose of the Cincinnati Reds gambling on baseball games while he played for and managed the Reds, baseball has a history of what I would call ethics transgressions. Does the seeming acceptance of cheating in our national pastime and perhaps other sports say something about the fans and maybe citizens' acceptance of cheating, lying, and otherwise unethical behavior in society? As we think about the values or golden rules we try to promote to our youth, being ethical seems to be an appropriate one. Yet if Major League Baseball, sort of like mom and apple pie, can cheat, what does that say about our faith in other institutions, or maybe our role in looking the other way? The message the Houston Astros cheating story says to me is that, well, if cheating is okay for baseball, then it must be okay for corporations, government agencies, and politicians. And heck, maybe it's okay for me too? As usual, I don't have the answer, but I would suggest we all need to be a little bit more ethical in our actions towards each other and in how we conduct our public affairs, and maybe even raise our ethical expectations of government, politicians, and democratic institutions. The Houston Astros scandal is old news, but as Major League Baseball struggles back, this forces me to look even closer at our institutions and society, say governments and corporations. Are these systems rigged against us, against the little guy or average citizen? Are these institutions cheating, and how do we even know it? More important, does anyone really care? So, on a Thursday night at home, what do I do for entertainment? Do I watch the Fox News or CNN and all the clever political pundits, or do I check out what baseball teams are playing? I say, let's play ball.
Dr. Robert Smith is Dean of the College of Public Affairs and Administration at the University of Illinois, Springfield. There's a Bloomington man who wants to legally change his first name to Corona, and it has nothing to do with the coronavirus. Steve Harrison got the nickname because of the beer. He drank it all the time as a younger man, and while living in Mexico, he says he even appeared in a TV commercial for Corona. He's been subject to a little bit of teasing ever since the coronavirus pandemic began.
One friend came up to me in Walmart and said he had to, instead of hollering across the store, Corona, he said, I had to come over here and get your attention. People think what they want, you know, I don't care.
Last month, he filed the paperwork in court to legally change his name to Corona Steve Harrison. Illinois set aside $150 million in federal money to help families hurt by the coronavirus pandemic pay rent. Mary Hansen talks with Kristen Faust, executive director of the Illinois Housing Development Authority, which is administering the rental assistance program.
Right now, 15% of Illinoisans are out of work, and a higher number than that are afraid about how they're going to pay next month's rent or mortgage. So we know that the need and demand is really high.
I'm seeing, you know, folks on Facebook groups and other forums asking for help and wondering where and when they can get rental assistance quickly. When will they actually be able to get this money?
The rental program opens Monday, August 10th. So it's going to be open for less than 2 weeks. So it's an online application. The tenant goes in and applies, and then the landlord has to go in and apply. So we really want all the renters to apply next week. The window's open a little longer than that, but we want to make sure there's time for the landlord to then supply additional information, like the landlord has to supply the lease and how much rent is owed.
Who would qualify for this assistance?
So the program is really set up for working folks who got hit hard by the pandemic and lost their jobs or had decreased hours. You had to be working up through March 1 and have your rent paid current through February. But then sometime after March 1, you lost income due to the pandemic. An additional eligibility factor is that this is geared towards working people earning around $63,000 a year household, where, you know, we're trying to reach moderate income households and less fortunate households.
If you're, you know, able to pay this month's rent, but you're behind, you know, 2 or 3 months before that, will this money cover that rent?
Yes, the money will cover back rent. In fact, it's designed to cover back rent. And also it can go forward through December. And so we know that the unemployment boost that has been so beneficial to people, you know, it just expired July 31. So there are people that had been able to pay their rent through that, but now they may not be able to pay August rent, right? So they could apply as well.
When the pandemic first hit, a lot of the folks who lost their jobs were trying to apply for unemployment, and that website got overwhelmed, and IDES had a lot of trouble processing all of those applications. How are you preparing for this influx of applications?
We've worked very hard to be able to accept a very high number of applications all at the same time. We're feeling confident that we'll be able to handle the number of applications that come in. I would encourage people, though, not everybody has to apply Monday morning at 9 a.m. Get your application in next week sometime between Monday and Friday. I would really encourage you to do that.
The amount that you're talking about might not come close to meeting the need. What else needs to be done to make sure that folks continue to be housed in Illinois?
So we have $150 million that we're going to be able to disperse in $5,000 grants. And so that will mean 30,000 different households across Illinois will be able to benefit from this program. But we just know, our senses and from the data and everything, we know that there's more people than that are in need. And so we work to finance more affordable housing and to make sure that there are more and more units of affordable housing in the state. But really, this crisis is of such a level that we need help from the federal government. We need a national response. That's what we got with the CARES Act money that got this money for this program. So we need a continued federal response. One, we need the unemployment boost needs to continue, right? There needs to be a continued boost to unemployment that helps people pay rent. And then we need more rental assistance. And ultimately, we need to build more affordable housing and we need more housing rental vouchers. I mean, COVID has really highlighted the fact that a stable place to live is so, so important. It's not just about a roof over your head. It's about your health. It's about so many things. But right now, it's about staying safe and not getting COVID-19 as well.
Reporter Mary Hansen talking with Kristen Faust, Executive Director of the Illinois Housing Development Authority. Chicago officials have a message for those from states with high COVID-19 counts. Please stay home. And if you must travel to the city, you must quarantine for 2 weeks once you arrive. But that quarantine order, even the threat of a $500 fine for breaking it, is not stopping some tourists from taking vacations and even day trips to Chicago. Mariah Wolfel went in search of some visitors at Chicago's Millennium Park.
It didn't take me long, less than an hour actually, to find around 10 people who should have been post-travel quarantining, but just couldn't help themselves.
Coming out to go explore, look at the sights. See new things.
We got some Chicago-style pizza. We went down to the harbor, and now we're at the Cloud Gate.
We had Luminati's for lunch, and then we'll probably have something similar for dinner.
Those are voices from Wisconsin, Arizona, and Kansas, three of 22 states currently on Chicago's quarantine order. A state makes the list once it starts seeing more than an average of 15 cases per 100,000 people a day. Visitors from those states, or Chicagoans who go there and come back, are supposed to quarantine in the city for 14 days before venturing out. But people told me they were either unaware or blatantly ignoring the rule.
Where are you from?
I am from Wichita, Kansas.
Kansas, that's on the list.
It is.
Okay, and you knew it was on the list?
Yeah.
Yeah, he knew Kansas was on the list, but he doesn't care, he tells me.
2 week quarantine really isn't an option, and we had this trip planned long before all of this stuff, so we were going to back out of it just because of an order that's unenforceable.
He and his three friends had Lou Malnati's for lunch, planned to go to Wrigleyville in the evening and the Museum of Science and Industry the next day. Like most people breaking the city's rule, he asked us not to use his name, because even if he thinks it's unenforceable, the fines are steep. The city can fine you up to $500 each day you refuse to quarantine. Officials say they're monitoring social media, but not putting as many resources into enforcement as other states might be. For instance, in Hawaii, travelers from hotspot states have to sign a form and provide information for where they plan to quarantine. Instead, Chicago Public Health Commissioner Dr. Allison Arwady described the order as sort of an honor system.
The primary goal is education, asking people to do the right thing, helping people recognize that there is significant personal risk when people are traveling to states where the outbreak is in very poor control, and that when they return to Chicago or if they visit Chicago, they are in turn bringing that risk to others.
Back at Millennium Park, two friends, Kat from Wisconsin and Logan from Arizona, drove down from Wisconsin for a day trip. They told me while they were aware of the order, they had trouble following what they think is conflicting advice from public officials.
It's really hard to tell. It's kind of hard to be cooped up and hidden and then, you know, attacked with fear all the time. And then they're trying to get the economy and everyone back to normal. So it's like, well, how do you do that when you say stay at home, but then you can go places?
So they said they were doing what they thought was necessary to stay safe while allowing themselves to explore a new city.
Wear a mask when we're out.
wash our hands constantly, hand sanitizer, keeping our distance from people. I'm just rolling with it. It's a weird time we're living in. I'm not going to let it scare me. I'm just going to do what I can to keep myself and the people I care about safe.
Every other visitor I spoke to was also wearing a mask. Mariah Wolfel, WBEZ News.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. We're glad you could join us. Be with us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Our website is statewideshow.com. You can find links to the stories you hear each week and all of our past episodes there. Our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.